You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
I'm Terrence Houston, and this is The Ecologist Goes to Washington, a podcast program by the Ecological Society of America, where we interview scientists involved with public policy. Today, I'll be interviewing Caitlin McDonald McKenzie with Boston University. Caitlin is one of this year's four Graduate Student Policy Award winners. Much of your PhD research is based in Acadia National Park and funded through the National Park Service. Could you talk a little bit about your research?
Sure. I study long-term changes in flowering phenology and local abundance across plant communities in the Northeast. So I'm interested in the ecological effects of climate change and land use change. So when I'm looking at a landscape, I'm often wondering to myself, what grew here 100 years ago? Are the plants flowering earlier now than they did before? And why did some species become more common while others are much more rare than they used to be? So in Acadia, I do a combination of historical detective work and classic field work. I spent the past two summers looking for old records of flowering times and local abundances in places like historical societies, archives, and herbaria. So this year I'm finally outdoors, and I've been hiking ridges within the park to monitor flowering phenology across different elevations. So it's been a really wonderful spring where I'm walking the same trails over and over, but each time I get to find a new twig leafing out or a new plant in flower or a new herb emerging from the litter.
Out of curiosity, what prompted your interest in climate change and its impact on plants, and why do you think it's important for us to know?
Well, I've always loved being outdoors, and I've been interested in biology and ecology since I was a little kid. I remember hearing Jane Goodall speak at my school and thinking that she just had the most amazing life. There was one thing that struck me about her work. Sometimes it was hard for her to find a specific chimpanzee. So I like plants because they stay where you leave them. And in terms of studying climate change in plants, I'm really struck by this quote from E.B. White, the author of Charlotte's Web. And he said, "I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve or save the world and a desire to enjoy or savor the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." So by studying climate change in plants, I kind of have a solution to planning my day around saving and savoring the world. I get to hike mountains and climb trees and spend time with flowers. But at the end of the day, when I enter all my data and run my analyses, I hope this research will help us to understand the ecological effects of climate change. And understanding how climate change has already impacted the plant communities allows us to better predict what we can expect in a warmer future and to figure out what we can do to manage protected landscapes for maximum conservation. So just last week, we passed 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So even under the most optimistic climate change mitigation scenarios, the Acadia that my kids will visit will clearly not be the same landscape that I've known since I was little. But maybe my work will allow us to identify plants that are particularly vulnerable to climate change and direct resources towards monitoring and protecting them.
What experiences did you draw on for your meetings on Capitol Hill?
Well, I go back to my high school every year to talk to AP biology students about careers in science. And I'm not saying that politicians and staffers are like high schoolers necessarily, but this repeated experience of talking about my research to a new audience outside of, you know, scientific conferences or graduate seminars, it was definitely helpful for me as I prepared for meetings on Capitol Hill. So with high schoolers, you really need to have a good hook for short attention spans, and I think that was pretty relevant when you only have 10 or 15 minutes for a meeting. And in general, I credit my interdisciplinary college major and the Field Naturalist Master's Program at University of Vermont. So my entire academic career has held this through line where I have this focus on communicating scientific research beyond the scientific community. And my background in tying together concepts from different disciplines, I think, made it easier for me to jump from fieldwork into a business suit and to kind of find my sea legs in this new environment and launch into conversations about my research with people who probably previously thought that phenology was the study of predicting your character traits from the bumps on your head.
During your meetings with congressional offices, did you find you were effectively able to convey the value of federally funded research? Were there particular aspects of what you said or points you made during the meetings that seemed to resonate particularly well with policymakers?
So, yes, we were definitely able to convey the value of federally funded research. But in general, the Massachusetts delegation was not a hard sell. So as a Massachusetts native and a Harvard grad and a current BU student, I'm really proud to know that my congressmen and women wholeheartedly support education, research, National Science Foundation funding, and acting to mitigate climate change. However, it did make the congressional visits day almost too easy. We had a BU grad student, a Northeastern grad student, and an MIM in these Massachusetts offices. And the staffers loved delving into some of the more technical details about our research. We got to talk to a couple AAAS fellows, which was really nice. And since Boston is home to so many universities and colleges, I think this really resonated with the staffers that we saw. And they seemed impressed in general that grad students took time to step away from labs and fieldwork and come to DC to share our experience with them. Yeah, it was nice to be able to thank them for sticking up for us. And it was kind of a mutual supportive situation where we walked away feeling like we had support from them. And it was nice to be able to give them, you know, really specific examples of how federal funding had helped us.
I know you've been directly affected by the budget sequester that went into effect on March 1st of this year. Would you elaborate on the impact of the sequester on your research and on the response you got from congressional offices when you told them about this?
Sure. So when I applied for the Graduate Student Policy Award in January, I was really sitting pretty. I had just fulfilled all my required coursework. I was finished with teaching assignments. I had about 10 weeks before I had to take my qualifying exam, so I wasn't panicked about that yet. And on March 1st, I would have this 2-year grant from the National Park Service that would begin funding my research. So I was living this graduate student dream where I had stability and I was done with teaching and I had all these amazing plans for 2 future field seasons at Acadia National Park. And when the sequester hit, that whole dream disappeared. So I was at this point, you know, just weeks away from my qualifying exams, and I was supposed to begin my field season by the end of the month. I was hoping to be in Acadia at the end of March, and suddenly I wasn't even sure that I would have a field season. So it was really stressful to suddenly have everything that I had planned just completely disappear. So by the time that I arrived in D.C., I had passed my qualifying exams, I had begun my field season, which was this incredible feat, totally made possible by my advisor and the science coordinator at Acadia. They were able to scrounge up, emergency funding basically from other sources just to cover me for the summer. And the 2-year dream was kind of gone, but at least I could do my field work and then figure it out later. But basically, by mid-April, when we were in D.C., it seemed like people in D.C. had kind of forgotten about the sequester. It had lost this immediacy. But for me, it was still a very immediate thing. So during the congressional visits day, I talked about the sequester every chance I got. And I was really lucky that my lab had NSF funding when my Park Service grant was sequestered. And that kind of fit into our narrative of asking for sustained NSF support from our congresspeople. But I also wanted to use this opportunity to remind my congresspeople that sequester was already hurting science. So I received a lot of commiseration from the Massachusetts delegation. But again, because it's Massachusetts, I was kind of preaching to the choir there. But at this point, I just want to, you know, put it out there again that sequester is definitely affecting science. While my research is kind of struggling to figure out how I'm going to continue doing this fieldwork, I'm also surrounded by a bunch of people who work for the National Park Service and are facing similar challenges. So it's actually kind of nice to be up here and have this community support, but it's also really frustrating when we see the effects of sequester every day, and it seems like everyone in D.C. has kind of forgotten about it. It's funny because the park is opening about a month later than it used to, and that means that some of my transects, which have trailheads right off of the Park Loop Road, are now only accessible if I hike 3 miles on the road to get to the start of my hike. So in some way, the sequester is just kind of like this annoyance where every day I have to do an extra hike along the road. And then I get back to the office and start entering my data, and I realize that everyone around me is suffering. You know, there's more furloughs, there's less staff. And so hiking on a road for 3 miles seems kind of silly to complain about when I'm actually up here and I have this, you know, backup funding that was able to support me. But it's kind of amazing how the sequester is a really daily interaction here at Acadia. And it really seemed like, you know, completely forgotten when I was in D.C.
What advice would you give to other young scientists seeking to engage in public policy?
I guess just keep talking. Early in my career, I worked with the Nature Conservancy, and during my master's research, I partnered with the Appalachian Mountain Club. And both of these organizations are engaged in public policy, and through their research departments are pretty small and scrappy, but I found that working with those organizations to be very rewarding, because when you're already plugged into that structure, it's easy to see how your work fits into management decisions. In general, I love doing work up here in a national park because there's so many opportunities to share your research with the community. And so I've written essays for the Friends of Acadia Journal. I've given lunchtime talks, guest posts on local natural history blogs. And so these informal settings really allowed me to hone my elevator pitch. And these experiences have kind of made me more comfortable communicating science to a wider audience. So a huge part of, I think, of engaging in public policy is just being an engaging speaker. And so you have to be able to get non-scientists interested in your work. And it's not really about dumbing down the science, but really making it accessible to find that angle that will make your questions pop. And I think it's tough, especially after the first couple of years of graduate school, where you are constantly just thinking in terms of like NSF proposal guidelines and digging through like the supplementary materials for methods to Nature papers. So getting out of that kind of mindset, talk about your work, to talk to, you know, your mom or your friends from college who went into finance or your bartender or your mailman, talking through it, eventually you start to have a story that will be really engaging to policymakers.
And that was Caitlin McDonald McKenzie. Thanks so much for listening, and please join us next time when The Ecologist Goes to Washington.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.